Fantastic start. Thank you very much, Caleb. Really welcomes our new city poet with this engagement, and the youth mayor's again outstanding as usual. This has been an incredibly humbling year for humanity. I think in the modern age, when we've looked at any crises, we've generally had the view that someone somewhere could solve it if they chose to. We've been of the mind that CEOs, politicians, or scientists could just make decisions to end poverty, end hunger, house people, or even stop wars. And I think this might be the first time in the modern era that we've had to confront the limits of human power in facing up to the fact that there is no individual or group anywhere out there who can just solve this, even if they wanted to. So I've got three, just to start, three main reflections on the year. First, COVID is testing every system we depend on: our education system, our food system, our transport systems, our democratic systems, our economic system. And while we have our heroes who have fought to keep things going, the systems themselves have been found wanting. School and exams have been missed. Jobs have been lost. People have gone hungry. Transport has ground to a halt. Elections were cancelled. And we are on the cusp of the deepest economic depression since the 1930s. Second, COVID is not indiscriminate. Viruses get disproportionate opportunity to attack vulnerable individuals through weaknesses in our systems. It has exposed our inequalities. It's those in the lower socioeconomic groups, in overcrowded housing, frontline jobs, Black people, Asian people, poor people, those with pre-existing health conditions who have been hit hardest by COVID and the consequences of the lockdown. It has exposed the national weakness resulting from the political and economic system in general and 10 years of austerity and the disinvestment in society in particular. This not least because it has left public organizations, local government, and public health under-equipped for this shock. Third, COVID is a crisis that is forcing us to rethink who and how we are. For some, COVID will be a point of difference, division, and suspicion. For others, it will drive them to think about our interdependence. Think back to those early reports from Wuhan. If you were like me, you cared, but it was one of those crises over there. I think back to the Global Parliament and Mayors Conference we hosted in Bristol in 2018. Nearly 100 mayors, their staff, the United Nations, the World Health Organization, all in Bristol. We focused on three priorities. Urban security and migration made sense to me. The third was city preparedness for pandemics. Even then, to me, pandemics felt like a distant threat, something for mayors from the global east and south, to plan for and address. And yet today, the threat that was over there is causing pain, loss, and death for families over here. So I want to begin by expressing my sympathy and condolences to all those families who have experienced loss. I think particularly about those who have lost loved ones and not been able to hold the funerals families would have wished, and then having to grieve in isolation alone. And the losses we have faced have not just been about death. Many people have lost jobs, personal relationships, and their financial security. Others have lost mental health and falling into depression. Domestic violence has increased. Calls to Childline have risen. People have lost their homes as places of safety. In a recent comment, Prince Charles warned, "There has never been a time as uniquely challenging as the present, when the pandemic has left perhaps another million young people needing urgent help to protect their futures. The task ahead is unquestionably vast, but it is not insurmountable. The consequences will not disappear the moment we get a medical breakthrough. The legacy of this will be with us for many years. We will not be able to heal all the hurts, but we can commit to be in a city in which healing and hope is possible." So I want to say thank you to those many people who were helping making the Healing Hopeful Bristol a reality. From the medics who risked their lives to deal with the virus, to the community organizations who have distributed food, to businesses and unions who have tried to keep people in work safe. I talked earlier about the COVID testing our systems. Something that has stood up to the test is society. Thousands of people volunteered through the Can Do Bristol website. Many thousands more set up their own groups or simply took care of family and neighbours. And we tasted something special, I think, and spiritually fulfilling as we turned out together to clap for our carers. There are many, many people and organisations I could name, but I will pull out just a few. Our nurses and doctors, NHS support staff, pharmacists, paramedics, ambulance crews, and all the public health professionals. I want to mention Caring in Bristol and the Cheers Drive project. Our care workers looking after people in their own homes and in our care homes. Our foster parents, those who had to shield, and those who came forward in response to our appeal for more families for Bristol children. Bristol's cleaners in hospitals, health centres, in all buildings. We now know just how critical they are. Our hoteliers who worked with us to provide shelter to our homeless. Retail workers who kept local shops and supermarkets open, and delivery drivers who kept shops and homes supplied. Of course, I need to mention the Bristol Food Union, Feeding Bristol, Bristol Food Banks and the Hunger Programme volunteers, like the Dawat-e-Tehsin Islami charity, a mosque-based food bank, and particularly the work of James Edwards, Projects and Partnerships Manager of the Bristol City Robins Foundation, and, I must add, Adam Tutton, Chief Executive of the Bristol Rovers Community Trust. There are individual examples from all over the city, like Mr. Chutter, who runs the Fulford Fish Bar in Hartcliffe. His business had to close for the lockdown, but before doing so, he offered fish and chip lots to people in the local community who were struggling. I want to celebrate Usdaw's campaign to protect retail workers from abuse, threats and violence, and thank the Community Meals Team and our National Food Service. Our drivers in Bristol Community Transport, First West, Stagecoach Southwest, who kept public transport moving, to our taxi drivers, many of whom became delivery drivers as we sought to get emergency food out to people. We owe so much to our teachers and school support staff for getting kids back to schools and meeting the educational and pastoral needs of children when they were at home under lockdown. Parents who have balanced family life, homeschooling and work, and our postal and logistics workers from the Royal Mail to Amazon, they have literally continued to deliver. We owe huge thanks to our community centres and the people that work in them. The people and places open their doors to often isolated people and keep communities together. Places like Lotley's Community Orchard Project and The Vench, as well as their near neighbours Southmead Development Trust and the Greenway Centre, and the volunteers of the Ardar Community Trust, breathing life back into community places that were in decline. If we didn't know it already, we do now, that our voluntary community sector is critical to our resilience. People like 125 and off the record, reaching people in ways that many of the big providers cannot or will not. The same goes for organisations like Empire Fighting Chance, transforming young lives through boxing, and who all found innovative ways to keep their support going. The volunteers working in community media, Ujima and BCFM in particular, and the critical part they played working with us to get the COVID messages to people who were too easily missed. And the mainstream media, who supported our public health messages, particularly at Radio Bristol. We want to thank Bristol Waste Crews, who continue to collect our rubbish and clean our streets. Our park services teams and park volunteers, our housing responsive repairs team and tenant support groups. And I want to thank our cemeteries and crematoria teams, who have stepped up in incredibly difficult times. Together we have lived, worked and cared for others in a way that has kept communities safe and supported those in vulnerable situations. Now I must be clear about the scale of the challenge facing us because it is significant. We have the scientific challenge of fighting the virus itself, protecting the National Health Service and that search for a vaccine. But we have to face up to the reality that a vaccine will not come down and cover us with an impenetrable shield that will allow us to return to life as we once knew it. We need to prepare now for the new normals. The virus will continue to be with us, mutating into new strains, targeting the vulnerable. And we face the consequences of the lockdown measures put in place to contain the spread of the virus, including what is likely to be the deepest economic depression in decades. The employment rate in Bristol in recent years has been the highest of the British core cities and 1% above the national average. But from March to August, unemployment had more than doubled to 4.5%. By August, 70,000 people of eligible employment in Bristol were furloughed. That's 30,000, that's 30% of our employees. That was a third higher than at the end of May. It was the highest among 16 to 25-year-olds, where 44% of eligible employees in that age group were furloughed. Bristol's economy has at least 8,000 fewer jobs. A recent Business West survey showed that 37% of firms are looking to reduce labour costs, even as they were accessing the national furlough scheme. And only 6% of companies are recruiting compared to 15.7% at the same time last year. The employment of young people in Bristol is heavily concentrated in the retail, hospitality and food sectors, with around 40% of young people in employment in our city in those industries. That is double the rate for all ages in employment, and they are in the very sectors with facing the biggest risks. Looking at the furlough numbers can guide our understanding of projected jobs at risk. So in the region, 78% of workers in the accommodation and food services sectors were furloughed, 72% in the arts, entertainment and recreation sector, 63% in construction, 42% in the wholesale, retail and motor trade sectors. Huge numbers of jobs that will undoubtedly be at risk in a prolonged recession. 4.5% of the UK workforce is employed in the cultural and creative industries. That's over 10,000 workers in Bristol. 70% of those are or have been furloughed, and many are further at risk. 56% of film and TV production companies have cancelled planned work. Events and festivals have lost 11.5 million visitors nationally. Average combined weekly loss of incomes across the city's cultural organisations range between £315,000 and £375,000, with predictions that many organisations have exhausted unrestricted reserves by the end of the autumn. The combined economic impact on our museums is over £35 million lost. Nearly two-thirds of festival and event organisers were forced to cancel planned events. 42 of the large outdoor, indoor festival and live events responded identified a £5 million loss due to cancellations in summer 2020, with a further £6.5 million impact on the wider supply chain. There's been a 40% reduction in civil aerospace orders and jobs already lost in the north of the city in that sector. The retail sector alone in Bristol is forecast to cut 1,600 jobs during this year. We anticipate inequality widening. It is the most vulnerable and working people who will take the biggest hit from the downturn. And it is they who will be least well placed to benefit from any economic upturn when it comes. Hardship will be particularly pronounced in lower super output areas in neighbourhoods from Hartcliffe to Hillfields, from Lawrence Hill to Lockleys and Lawrence Weston. Further and rising infection rates, a winter spike alongside the usual winter pressures on the NHS will build pressure on our health systems. we face business failures and rising unemployment, a return to evictions, burnout of workers in public services and schools, a spike in mental health pressures, and maybe a more dramatic public reaction along with greater community tensions and rising crime. And as need in the city rises, we in Bristol are joining other local authorities across the country in challenging national government to face up to the reality that the amount of financial support they are providing is not enough to enable us to meet the scale of need. Government have put £10 billion into the problematic national test and trace system, much of it going on contracts with private firms like Serco and G4S. This amounts to more than 100 times Public Health England's £90 million annual budget for infectious disease and 25 times the £400 million divided among the 343 English local authorities to spend on test, trace, contain and outbreak plans. Bristol is actually facing a £14 million hit this year and a £22 million hit next of funds not covered by the government. And so we find ourselves in the middle of a pandemic, on the cusp of an economic depression, with a model of national governance that holds power tightly in Westminster and Whitehall, who are looking increasingly likely to add a no-deal Brexit to our uncertainty. If there is one thing I hope government is learning, is that there is huge resource and expertise available to them if they work effectively with local leaders and place shapers in towns and cities across the country. At the city gathering in the summer of 2018, Bristol was presented with a plaque declaring us a city of hope. As with all such declarations, there is much about the possibility that is in us and what we want to be as they are about what we actually are. Hope isn't merely an attitude, belief or status. It is something we continually work to create. I have often cited the proverb, suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character and character hope. The suffering we are facing can be a step toward hope. But the movement from suffering to perseverance is not guaranteed. Without support and leadership, suffering can pull people and communities apart. It's our job to fight for the investment in lives that mean we come through these trials stronger, more resilient, more sustainable, more together than we were before. That is how we build back better. And it takes thoughtful, good policy and leadership. In an article in The Lancet, Richard Horton, The Lancet's editor-in-chief, and I understand a former student at Bristol Grammar School, argues we need to develop our understanding of COVID. He suggests we are not suffering merely from a pandemic, but a syndemic, in which two categories of diseases are interacting, the communicable disease, COVID-19, and non-communicable diseases that cluster around poverty and inequality, such as cardiovascular disease and obesity. The aggregation of these diseases on a background of inequality exacerbates the adverse effects of both. And as Richard went on to say, the most important consequence of seeing COVID-19 as a syndemic is to underline its social origins. The vulnerability of older citizens, black, Asian and minority ethnic communities and key workers who are commonly poorly paid with fewer welfare protections points to a truth so far barely acknowledged, namely that no matter how effective a treatment or protective a vaccine, the pursuit of a purely biomedical solution to COVID-19 will fail. Unless government devises policies and programs to reverse profound disparities, our societies will never be truly COVID-19 secure. And he continued, our societies need hope. The economic crisis that is advancing towards us will not be solved by a drug or a vaccine. Nothing less than national revival is needed. Approaching COVID-19 as a syndemic will invite a larger vision, one encompassing education, employment, housing, food, and environment. Viewing COVID-19 only as a pandemic excludes such a broader but necessary prospectus. This speaks to the warning that we and other local authorities have made to government since the beginning, that this crisis is short-changed if we only measure it in terms of NHS capacity and ICU beds. This is a social crisis. And unless we deal with the underlying weaknesses in our society, we will be constantly vulnerable. Moreover, that vulnerability will be with us as we move into a future where shocks, be they economic, environmental or social, are predicted to be more common. The themes that Horton points out resonate with the foundations of our approach to Bristol. We will continue in our commitment to deliver them. On employment, with Bristol Partners, we have developed our economic renewal strategy, and we will deliver on it. We must increase the city's resilience and sustainability alongside enhancing the social and economic well-being of every community. Our priorities include working with business and unions with the aim of protecting existing employment levels, building skills and pathways to work for young people where the impact is currently being felt most profoundly, and create opportunities for employment, especially by supporting green industries. We will support business, promote digital innovation, and work to attract new and established businesses into the city in the way we did with Channel 4, now up and running and employing Bristolians. And we have allocated capital funds to a COVID response fund. £4 million will be made available this year and £6 million next year to support recovery. We're asking government to front-load investment in our green infrastructure to bring forward funding for infrastructure in jobs and to support the local supply chain, while also allowing us to benefit from the decarbonisation of economic growth from now. Investment in this area will allow us to capture the benefits of decarbonising our economic growth right now. Investing in Temple Meads will bring homes, jobs and a renovated train station. Western Harbour will bring forward 2,000 homes in a sustainable location. A transport plan will bring new and reopened stations, more biogas buses and a low carbon mass transit system that will transform people movement in the city. We will rebuild our flood defences for the 21st century and beyond, and renew the city's bridges and harbour walls. We will also continue to make Bristol attractive to investors in the UK and around the world. Along with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown and Labour mayors and leaders from across the country, we have laid out the need for a clear programme of job retention schemes and to use this opportunity to invest in a greener economy, to invest in transitions to lower carbon operations, transport and machinery replacement schemes, and to invest in advanced research and development to retrofit and invest in new technologies. I've written to the government to request a boost for their job retention schemes in the aerospace industry and other key sectors, along with my colleagues from the Core Cities Network and the city's trade union leaders. We have asked this government to do more to protect jobs, support key industries, and do as much as governments in other European countries. And we want to deliver decent quality jobs. We have now been officially recognised by the Living Wage Foundation as a living wage city. This is more than 1,750 people earning the real living wage, reducing the risk of in-work poverty for hundreds of families. We're driving our economy by coming together with local authorities and businesses from Cardiff and Newport, from Swansea to Swindon, Gloucester and Bath, to launch the Western Gateway. It provides us with a place at the government's table alongside the Northern Powerhouse and Midlands Engine. We need central government to back local and city governments to find more of the answers. The government references levelling up, but continues to drive a Westminster-led agenda, underfunding city and local government that undermines the possibility of an inclusive recovery. The impact of COVID-19 on our economies and fiscal outcomes is huge. Now we have to invest in communities, in sustainable-led industry, and in social economic infrastructure. As has recently been said by the Centre for Progressive Policy, having borrowed at record levels, now we must invest in local economies and local institutions that can deliver rapid, systemic and sustainable change. With the devolution white paper delayed and a lack of commitment to localising solutions when that is clearly required. I echo the comments of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who said, "The new normal of living with COVID-19 will only be sustainable or even endurable if we challenge our addiction to centralisation and go back to an age-old principle. Only do centrally what must be done centrally." On housing, the virus has already had a dramatic impact on our biggest existing challenges. To have a home is the single biggest determinant of life outcomes. Both the Brexit uncertainty and the COVID crisis has had a significant impact on the construction sector. But we know the housing crisis is sharper than even than ever. And we will return to our stretching targets and continue to build homes, including affordable homes and council houses. I'm proud of our delivery on housing. We have converted the council to a delivery organisation from a standing start. And the numbers speak for themselves, as do the cranes on the city's horizon. We have built just short of 7,000 homes since 2016 and around 1,000 affordable. We have built up a council housing programme of over 1,200 homes, the largest council housing development programme in this city for over 35 years. When we add the pipeline of projects to our housing company is working on, this rises to almost 2,500 council homes to be built in Bristol. The days I visit people in their new homes, often the first time a family has had a quality, stable home, are the best days in the job. Knowing we have delivered security, health and better life outcomes for real people gives this job real meaning. That's why building homes remains a key focus. Quality, affordable homes are essential to building an inclusive city. The kind of homes we build and where we build them will be the biggest determinant of our environmental footprint, reducing our carbon emissions and impact on nature and wildlife. And on COVID, building homes that build communities means people will live within the kind of social support networks that we have seen are crucial to our resilience and our ability to overcome shocks. On education, we are delivering on thousands of work experience placements, continuing the Reading City project, keeping libraries open. We are supporting the Commission on Race Equality to increase diversity in our teaching staff and increasing the spend for children with special educational needs and disabled children, expanding classroom spaces and building new schools. On food, tackling child hunger has remained a key focus. As one of my core 2016 pledges, we have delivered with partners in Feeding Bristol, another scheme set out our ambition to achieve Going for Gold standard and exploring plans for food growing schemes in every ward in the city to support sustainability and tackle food poverty. On the environment, we are working with partners through the Environment Board to deliver our climate change response plan. Accelerating our work to complete pedestrianisation of the Old City, a bus gate at Bristol Bridge, closure of Baldwin Street to through traffic are steps towards cleaner air and healthier, more vibrant retail and entertainment-led city centre areas. Rather than expanding the simplistic and outdated residence parking zones, we are working with communities towards livable streets, improving the public realm, enhancing public transport and active travel. We are seeking more powers to tackle solid fuel burners and polluting construction equipment. As the city continues to grow, we must also improve our transport infrastructure. Changing the way we manage through traffic and working with the city on travel change and shifting work patterns, we will clean our air without financial penalties on the very households and businesses who need financial support at this time and who need to be able to access jobs now and in the future. And we will deliver against Bristol's transport plan with the bus deal and the strategic outline business case for the mass transit system by next spring. We have taken key steps towards enhancing our lives by reversing dramatic declines in wildlife, restoring the natural environment. Along with the Environment Board, Avon Wildlife Trust has led on the design of a city ecological emergency strategy that commits us to 30% of our land to be managed for the benefit of wildlife, to halve the use of pesticides, improve water quality, and to work with communities and businesses to reduce the consumption of products that undermine the health and habitat of wildlife. Now, we will build for recovery, but we will be alive to the risk that a dash for growth may end up subjecting us to a growth strategy that is values-free. We cannot afford that. We need to build back with our values to deliver a new normal that has inclusion and sustainability at its core. We need to plan and build our future against the likelihood of future shocks while reducing the contribution we make to the likelihood of future shocks. That is why we have put the economic recovery strategy, climate strategy, and the ecological strategy at the heart of our planning. We built these strategies to deliver the sustainable development goals. We have a strong local commitment to tackle global challenges through local initiatives and collaboration. Through the global goals, we will harness the private, public, voluntary, and academic sectors in solutions. Poverty, hunger, public health, well-being, education, equality, clean air and water, clean energy, decent jobs, innovation, sustainable inclusive growth, climate, wildlife and habitat, justice, partnerships. The Sustainable Development Goals underpin the way we work and will underpin our recovery, our journey to hope. These global goals will allow us to contribute also to the conversations happening right now around the world amongst the global network of cities who are stepping up to lead while national governments flounder. Moreover, it's our judgment that investment, global investment, will flow to the most resilient cities, those cities that are least vulnerable to climate shocks, floods, economic collapse and social disorder. And investors will gravitate toward green growth opportunities and all the reputational advantage that will bring in addition to the financial returns they seek. We have set out our city plan as a roadmap for the future, led by the Sustainable Development Goals, recognising the interdependency, acknowledging that tackling poverty must go hand in hand with improving health and education, reducing inequality, stimulating growth, and tackling climate change. My final message tonight is this. This crisis can only be overcome by the city coming together, our citizens and our organisations. We must recognise this is a syndemic. We must tackle the social determinants of health and inequality, as well as the biomedical determinants of health. We must come to terms with the fact that the virus will be with us in our lives for the foreseeable future. We must learn to adapt to the new normals. We will need to design and build COVID-secure environments and learn and adopt COVID-safe behaviours. There will be no certainty from the top, and so we must familiarise ourselves with the principles of how COVID is passed on from one person to another and allow this knowledge to shape our behaviour to keep ourselves and others safe. And I want to reflect once more on our commitment to be in a city of hope. It's in our One City plan. It's in Bristol City Council's corporate strategy. It is one of our core commitments, and we will hold strong to that commitment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marvin. Just to remind people, my name's Andrew Kelly from Festival of Ideas, and I'll be hosting the post-State of the City address interview session.
It's a challenge, right? But actually, I was on a call today every Wednesday between 12:30 and 1:30. We have what we call the City Leaders Call, leaders from police, universities, transport, schools, voluntary sector, creative sector, care homes. And 15, 20 people come together to connect and to talk about our impact on the city and how we navigate the city. That wouldn't be happening without this crisis. So that group has been quite phenomenal. It's been a technical group in terms of people that talked about specific challenges, but it's also been quite people don't burst into tears and all that, but it's been an emotional support. So in many ways, it's been a very, very challenging year, but it's provided an incredible opportunity to learn about and see the growth of the strength of relationships within the city. And I guess with all challenges, you get that mixed bag. People see you want a checklist of this, that and the other, stuff that you can just control. To be honest, the biggest need I have now, and I think the city needs to be able to take control of its future, is to get certainty over that future investment package. That one of the best things government could do to help us to begin to get organised is to make solid declarations about the investment package coming our way. Mass transit, Temple Meads, house building, flood defence, rebuild our harbour walls, invest in our bridges. If we had that declared right now, we could begin to organise our local supply chain, our skills base, build the inclusive economy. Without that certainty, it's that uncertainty that robs us of the opportunity to plan. And when your planning ability is undermined, you lose power. So it's not just a checklist of decision-making opportunities passed down. It's about the framework in which we work that's essential. But right now, I would welcome the chart. I just think what I would like government to do is talk to us much, much earlier about its COVID response plans. Right from the very beginning, Andrew, I was pointing out that local authority leaders were watching the news every night to find out about the government's latest position on COVID at the same time as everyone else. That's not okay. We're in governance, so then our finance team are hearing about an announcement for business support packages, going home that night, trying to work out what that means for Bristol City Council while all the you know, questions start coming in when we find out at the same time as everyone else. It's no way to run a country. So more certainty, more upstream, and I like government to actually talk to us so we can make sure that whatever they declare is locally locally appropriate. 10 o'clock curfew is a classic. Our concern is that a 10 o'clock curfew and that hard stop means that people are being passed from a COVID secure environment to a COVID insecure environment on the streets all at the same time, mass congestion. It's an unintended consequence. We know what the intention was, but the unintended consequences is an enhanced risk to our population. Could have talked to us about that. We have more control over how it's implemented locally.
And just explain to us, you know, you've got Andy Burnham being very vocal now about the way Manchester is being treated. Will you be in a similar position in terms of having to decide about different tiers or in terms of more protections and so on?
Well, we need to be. I certainly think that certainly government would have heard the message of the need to talk to authorities across the country before they steam ahead. And that's not just about... I mean, if you come and talk to us in Bristol, right? If the government say I want to come and talk to Bristol, I'm not just going to pitch up with myself, you know, and you know, a deputy mayor and a few council officers. I'll come with Business West, with our universities, with our cultural sector, with our voluntary sector, with our police. We will come as a collective and begin to talk about the city systems. That is just the way we work down here now. So again, it's not government needs to understand it's not just about the balance of power between it, a Conservative central government and a Labour-run local authority. That's not how we're running things. We are trying to get that collective voice, that collective understanding. And that's the offer. And that's what government must, for the sake of any hope, start engaging with that.
And one of the interesting things I've been reading about in terms of extending democracy is that city mayors and regional mayors should become members of a new, renewed House of Lords. Have you seen these arguments?
I haven't seen that. I can imagine Twitter going crazy now. that's not something I would comment on at the moment. But I haven't heard it.
Yeah.
There was promise, you'll remember, Andrew, when David Cameron came to Bristol to launch the whole mayoral initiative in 2012 and whenever it was. There was talk about there will be regular meetings between the mayors and the prime minister. That never happened.
I remember being in number 10 before George was elected the first time, and David Cameron said that he would create a cabinet of mayors chaired by him initially, and you're absolutely right, nothing resulted.
Well, I'm not going to make a cheap point here, but I will say that what's been great is that the leader of Newcastle, Nick Forbes, has been, and is leader on Labour on the LGA, has been attending Shadow Cabinet, which is great, and they're just regularly chirping in. Mm. you know, engaging. And there have been Conservative ministers who have been very proactive on the city's agenda and listening to cities, and that's been very, very welcome historically. You know, we've lost a couple of those, unfortunately, but we still think there was a kernel of hope in there. I think Eddie Lister, who went from chair of Homes England to work for Boris Johnson, has been, you know, real good support for the city's agenda as well in there. So, you know, there is hope. Well, I'm fearful of it coming back in the face of the economic depression and with the removal of protections against evictions, that, as I said in my speech there, we face a prospect of increasing levels of homelessness. That may not even be in-your-face street homelessness, rough sleeping. It would be the invisible homeless, people in temporary accommodation, sofa surfing, staying with other members of the family. That is a real, a real concern for us. I will say, though, that it's important the way we talk about it, because the hoteliers' scheme and getting rough people off the street, what it did was it took people off the street, but the fullness of the homelessness problem was never just about accommodation, isn't it? It's about mental health, you know, addictions, connections to families. So it tackled one element of the challenge, and we were able to engage with people on other elements, but clearly a number of fronts didn't. And actually, it was one of the cases we kept making to government. Now is the time to really push resource into all those services that wrap around rough sleepers, and allow us to while people are in Tuttlesit, to engage with them. I mean, there's a fantastic story as a friend of mine, Esther, that works at what used to be called the Crisis Centre, which is now called Hope, on Stapleton Road, working with rough sleepers. And she said that a guy came to her door delivering food, and she recognised him as one of the guys they used to work with who was homeless, and he had a job now. And she said, you know, wow, amazing to see you. And he said, yeah, I took the opportunity of being in the hotel to get the support I needed, and I got a job and I got somewhere to live now. Mm. So there was an opportunity there to take. We took as much of it as we can, but homelessness is going to be an ongoing challenge. It's also going to be around housing supply, a fundamental challenge of having enough homes for people that we have to bring through. And that's been massively challenged by Brexit, by COVID, and the impact that's had on the construction sector as well. But we're continuing to say, can we get that front loading of investment from government to keep that sector moving?
We had a number of questions about the difference between affordable housing and social housing and council housing. How can we move forward council housing, social housing more, do you think?
Well, we need the money to make it financially viable. What's also lost is a point I've made from about a year into my time in office. We face a lot of campaigns about specific frontline services, save this and save this building, save that service. But no one ever campaigns for the backroom staff, the lawyers, the planners, the housing officers. And these are the people that actually keep the cogs of the city moving. They're the ones who identify land, ready it, write for the grants from government, broker the deals, and, dare I say, enter into the negotiations with developers when they're contesting what share of any development can viably be brought forward as affordable. And, you know, that's an accountancy game as well that needs to be proven. So that backroom capacity is going to be really essential. I will share that only recently we sat in a room and with our executive director of growth and regeneration, look through all the things we wanted to do in Bristol. It's a fantastic list, big infrastructure projects, flood defence, all the things I mentioned. And we actually started to say, right, what's our priority? You've always got to have priorities, but it was a painful process because there were things that we'd like to do that we simply have not got capacity to do because of the size of local authority. I was after 10 years of austerity at the moment. So that's a painful process we're having to face up to. But again, that city leaders group that we've got, that's the place where we can talk about these things and begin to talk about how we support each other.
And just linked to that is the work that you've done in establishing the city office. There were a couple of questions about that. Do you want to talk about how that's going now?
I think the city office is great because it's developing a life of its own. I'll give you an example. So the city office is basically a recognition that what Bristol is not the result of the decisions of any single organisation. Right? People sit at the intersection of decisions made by us, the health service that we don't control, the universities that are small towns within Bristol, the police force, which is, again, it's its own organisation with its own elected political head of honesty. So I don't control everything. So the question is, how can we bring all of those kind of forces, as it were, together around a smaller number of shared priorities so we generally deliver for Bristol? That's the City Office bringing those organisations together to work in a much more coordinated way. And they've produced a Bristol One City plan. And that is us, as a collection of organisations, making a clear statement about what we want Bristol to be in 2050, and then working out what we need to do, what we need to achieve, what challenges we need to overcome every year in sequence. And that's important. You should do some things before others. Every year up to 2050 to get there. And the plan is important. If I can take space to use one swear word, as a friend of mine is in the army, he says, make a plan, any plan, just make a bloody plan, you know, and it's about just putting something down on paper, we can change it. Now, I'll give you an example of the way the City Office has worked, I think, really well, and it's how it's empowered civil society. So there's an environment board. We have six boards leading six strands within that One City plan. There's an environment board. In December last year, Ian Barrett, who's the chief executive of Avon Wildlife Trust, in the environment board said, it's fantastic we've declared a climate emergency. It's great we're doing work on the climate strategy, but that won't in and of itself solve the threat to nature and species extinction. So we need to take nature into account. So he said that. So I said, Ian, it'd be great to hear some more about that. By February, Ian had worked up a paper that he brought to Cabinet declaring an ecological emergency in Bristol, the first declaration of ecological emergency in the country. In September, we launched the City Ecological Strategy. It was not just about the council, about the zoo, about the universities, the health service, how we're going to collectively work to arrest species extinction and promote life and biodiversity within the city. The council didn't write it. What's happened is there's space for it. Civil society organisation came through, wrote it, and led the city. And Avon Wildlife Trust did an incredible job on it. And that's a real challenge for us now. But it's about not being afraid of having challenging documents put forward. 30% of land over to promoting nature, reduction of the use of pesticides, by halving the use of pesticides. These are city challenges, but they're ones that we are going to grapple with now. So first off, momentum can continue. It's just that not everyone knows about it, and it's not always loud. Mm. So I'll give you the classic example would be Colston Hall, now the Beacon Centre. The momentum about the changing of the name never let up. Right? It's just that it wasn't loud momentum, and it ultimately came out with the event recognising the name had been changed. But it has been incredibly welcome to have the voice of environment, because it's certainly raised up the political agenda and given us a platform to talk to national and international organisations. But we do need to see change. We will do what we can within our power within Bristol. The city plan has a whole track around environment. The environment board is driving those with and influencing the other strands in the city plan around housing, transport, education and skills, health and wellbeing, and the economy. We've got the sustainable development goals at the heart of what we do. We're actually being cited as a leading city on the world stage in SDGs. In fact, someone from the Commonwealth Local Government Forum said that he cites two cities when he talks about the SDGs, Kigali and Bristol, which is like incredible, right? And there's a sort of humility with that, because we know all the weaknesses in our city. I'm acutely aware of our weaknesses. But nonetheless, people are talking about what we do. But the urgency, Andrew, comes back to that point I've made earlier. We need government to front-load investment. So if I go to mayoral gatherings, and I was actually on the phone to someone from Open Society Foundation yesterday and talking about this. I don't want to go to more mayoral gatherings where mayors stand around and tell each other stories about great projects they've done in particular communities. If I go to a mayoral gathering and the mayor tells me about, we've done a fantastic job putting green walls all over the city, and it's cleaned up our air quality and it's made the place look fantastic. My first comment would be, sounds fantastic. My second comment is, how much did it cost? It costs money to do this stuff. If we put green walls up and we didn't have the expertise to maintain them, they would soon become brown walls of dead plants. It costs money to do stuff. It costs money to deliver a mass transit system, to deliver zero carbon homes. All that stuff costs money, and we need that money front loaded. That looks like momentum, right? And that's what people see and experience the change that's happening. That's why we're constantly banging on about it. Let's get the investment front loaded. Let's keep us moving while we have this window of opportunity, and we can begin to benefit from the decarbonising of growth right now, so that actually the growth we need is decarbonised by definition, rather than growing and then trying to retrofit social justice and climate friendliness onto it after the fact. It's too late then. So we've tried to capture that. That is actually the way we've put it. We've tried to capture that benefit by introducing the changes to the way traffic moves around the city. Highest profile, I guess, is the introducing a bus gate on Bristol Bridge, the closure of Baldwin Street to through private cars, only to buses now, and the pedestrianisation of the old city. And you people have, you know, they're not pretty at the moment, but it's because it's been done quickly. Broadening of pavements and the introduction of cycle lanes at key points within the city. All of that's been done with the aim of capturing that benefit. We always know there's going to be a pressure because that absence of traffic on Bristol streets was only ever temporary in response to the lockdown. Mm. But at the same time, we've mapped that into the bus deal, which is, so for example, the number two, which is a very important route that goes from one side of the city to the other through the centre, has been doubled in frequency. And that's what James Freeman has been offering. You know, the more we can deliver the prioritisation of bus routes, then he can increase the number of buses on the street and biogas buses. Mm. And that, actually, Andrew, is also important to understand that we've never seen that in isolation. We're not trying to take a project-by-project approach. The idea is that as we develop this culture around the use of public transport and active travel, that will continue to underpin the business case for the mass transit system, which we are in the process of building as well. Mm. So the £4 to £4.5 billion mass transit system that we want looks more financially attractive as we go to DFT and we go to international investors to get it delivered.
There were some specific questions about mass transit, which I'll leave for the office to answer. But another issue which has been mentioned, which was with us before the pandemic started, was about the future of international travel, and particularly about the future of Bristol International Airport. And that is going to come back as almost certainly as an appeal and so on. I mean, what do you think about the future of international travel and in terms of the airport and so on?
Well, I think international travel is going to be very different because people have got used to Zoom. Mm. I've participated in a number of Zoom calls with mayors from around the world. I was on one with C40, chaired by Mayor Garcetti, Yvonne Sawyer from Mayor Garcetti, is the mayor of Los Angeles, who's chair of C40, also sits on the Mayor's Migration Council with myself, and with Yvonne from Freetown, who sits on the Mayor's Migration Council and is a superstar mayor from the continent, the African continent. And that was easy. And I think we've got used to that, and culturally used to it, so it reduced. In fact, I will say, with the Global Parliament of Mayors, about this time last year, I tried to get us to take on a commitment to have mayors around the world commit to reducing their collective travel by about 50%, their collective air miles by 50%. It was just before C40. It was just a bit difficult to get the whole pitch worked up and mechanics of it. But we will see that. And the air travel is not going to come back for many, many years, which is what people are recognising. But herein is one of the dilemmas, and I'll say something about the dilemma. I talked about the loss of jobs, and this is why we cannot approach things as single-issue politics, right? The airport is a mass employer. The airline industry, is both in terms of flights and construction, is mass employers. And make a case against it, great, but you have to say something about jobs. Livelihoods, poverty, insecurity, and all the other things that begin to kick in when people experience that uncertainty, including, I would add, reactionary politics. So I saw a headline the other day about Trump, and it was from a politician in a coal-producing town, or it was someone in the coal industry, and they said, if Trump loses, we're finished. Vote Trump. Now, if we do stuff without giving people viable economic alternatives, we could end up with, well, you get the woke moment. You know, I've got the T-shirt, I was on the right side of history and I made the right statement. But what you've done is you shored up for yourself a horrific kind of politics in the medium to long term, reactionary, that denies climate change and so forth. So we have to do them both at the same time. Just about being wise. As I said to a friend of mine the other day from Extinction Rebellion, being right isn't enough. You have to have a plan. And you have to understand society, and you have to understand how you get that through. If being right was enough, we'd have ended racism and sexism by now. it takes more than being right. I think also, you know, just yeah, maybe I'll just leave that one there.
Okay. Well, let's move on to some others because we've still got quite.
That's my fear. Yeah. It says it on the tin. We're fearful about the Christmas period, how people are going to survive, both in terms of nighttime events, but everything that goes with it, like the nighttime economy. So actually with Nicola Beach and Craig Cheney, we're talking about what we might be able to do as a city to use some of the outdoor spaces, Lloyd's Amphitheatre. Now we've got pedestrianised Corn Street. Could we do something there to, and again in the winter, what can we do to make those places a little bit warmer? Maybe some marquees to allow businesses to expand out to hold events in COVID-secure environments. So we are very concerned about the winter. And yeah, we recognise that it was fantastic to get the good news for a number of our cultural sector organisations. And actually what was also welcome is there was quite a range of organisations in there as well. It wasn't just the the usual suspects. And we need to protect the usual suspects. They're iconic. Old Vic and so forth are iconic institutions within the city that are critical to our arts and culture offer. But it's great to get out beyond that as well, as they would say too. But we're very concerned beyond March. And this is where, Andrew, the point I was making about working with government to give us some certainty. Right? What is going to happen? Let's not end up the way we've always seemed to end up, with local authority leaders in places waiting on a knife edge with everyone else to find out about their future. Let's sit down, plan it out. Right? Let's have a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan of some sort. And I know it's harder to do that the further you get into the future, but have as in a world of uncertainty, let's give as much certainty as we can. Loading uncertainty upon uncertainty is not going to be helpful by any stretch of imagination.
I interviewed the mayor of Stockton recently, who I hope we can get you and him together at some point. You share similar upbringings and work areas, but his slogan is "Upset the setup," and I thought that was rather a good one, really.
I like it.
Yeah, well, you can have that one.
I will quote that. Goes along with my friend, says occupy the rhetoric. That's one I've sort of taken from someone.
You've got two now you can use. So
it comes back to trying to give as much certainty, Andrew. I think that I just enter into it. When I play in that mind experiment about what it must be to be a young person, you're quite young, you've missed school, you've got all that undefined uncertainty and jeopardy that's been put in your life. When I was a kid growing up, I was often quite terrified of the prospect of nuclear war. I had a plan in place. I was going to run round to my nan's house, right? I was with my mum. I was going to run round to my nan's house, see her, and then try and run to my aunt's house and see my cousins. And that was my... But I had that. But I also was aware it was kind of a long way away. Now, we're actually in a shock. And we're being told that there are the increasing likelihood of future shocks. We see the data around species extinction. We can see ice sheets falling off into the ocean. So I can understand that this kind of sense of what kind of world are we inheriting. We can see this kind of mad politics around Trumpianism and the echoes of it going around the world. How do we end up in a situation where someone like that ends up getting elected? I don't even just mean that. That doesn't start and end with him. He's part product and part fuel for a theme within politics that seems to have burst onto the public scene. That causes me anxiety, but I'm probably more than halfway through my life now. If you're just starting out, that's, I can understand that's a real challenge. It just comes back to, I'm just dying to get the certainty in, get the alignment between the investment, showing that we are physically changing our cities, towns, and our systems. That's what needs to change. Decarbonise transport system, decarbonise energy system, decarbonise waste system, decarbonise house, so we can live in a way that, whether we realise it or not, is not killing the planet. And we can live in a way that facilitates human relationships, social justice, economic inclusion and hope. I really think it's about reconceptualising, replanning and rebuilding our towns and cities across the planet.
Interestingly, we had a number of questions about science education and the importance of that, and particularly, I suppose, in the context of the pandemic. Talk generally about education as a whole, which you're very passionately committed to, and what are the likely developments there?
Well, very practically, we need to bring school places through as we are. We've got, you know, schools being built across the city as quick as we possibly can. They're coming through quite well. But I think on the future of education, one is it's massively important to me. It was my gateway. The day I went to university, I felt that I just turned a page in my book. I spent the age from 14, I was desperate to get out of my circumstances. And then once I crossed that line and got to sixth form, I knew that I had to get to university to change the physical and cultural environment in which I lived from one of almost demoralization and hopelessness that I experienced so often growing up to hope. It's a new dawn. And when I got to Swansea, I thought, oh, this is it. I've got hope now to move forward. But I think the future of education is going to be in line with what we've done, but it's going to have to take mental health much more into account. And that's going to be a challenge for teachers because they've got a lot on their table, on their desk already. The pressures to get exam results and taking care of their own mental health and well-being, the incredibly stressful time. But we're going to have to align personal, social development of children and young people with their academic level of attainment. So we're going to have to be thinking much more intentionally about personal resilience, not least because the thing that's been added to challenge children and young people today is social media. And the role that it has played in replacing the normal or the traditional ways of building up identity and personal resilience with likes, reposts, retweets, and the role that I think that is playing in undermining personal resilience, but not only undermining it, but removing those sources of strength that previous generations have had because they haven't had the opportunity to engage with them. So education is going to have to catch up with that. So on that leaders call we have every week, Una Goldsworthy's on that call, who's now head of Guinness, I believe, and he's a fantastic. Has been a fantastic person in the city delivering housing for years with United, but is now there as well. So she speaks into that care challenge, and Christina Gray, our Director of Public Health, is obviously all over it. And my cabinet lead for adult social care, Helen Godwin's one of the most experienced councillors, incredible councillors in the authority. So we have good people working on this, but we recognise it's, it's a huge challenge. So we are going to need to properly fund. And we don't get stuff for free. We're going to have to keep properly funding our care sector. It just goes without saying. And there's a lot of pressure. There always has been pressure on it. And the pressure on it, budgetary pressure on it, is increasing. But there are other things that need to happen too. So the work we did over the summer with our volunteers was about trying to mobilise that community resilience, that strength in communities that is out there, irrespective of public services, civil society, in, as it were. And hopefully some of that COVID recovery fund that we've got will also be there available to community groups to really to support them to be part of that that resilience and building society. I'm also quite nervous about the implications of Brexit, particularly a no-deal Brexit, for what it would mean for our caring staff. Many of our caring staff are from overseas, we do know that people have started to go home, back to countries of origin. This is their home, but back to countries of origin. And that is another challenge that we are mindful of, that we haven't heard absolute clarity from government on, that could be a major problem for us as well. Again, it's certainty, as much certainty as we can get is what we need. We just have to put it in front of us. We've been going through a process over the last few weeks of trying to map out the world that is before us. And we've been doing that with our city partners as well. So at the moment, it's a very unsophisticated looking Excel sheet that has strands on it. So some of the key dates, like the end of furlough, the end of protections against evictions, the US elections is plotted on it. The Brexit date is plotted on it. So we've got the key dates from momentous moments is plotted on this thing. But so are the trends, right? So growing inequality, what's happening with the levels of domestic violence. So we can think ahead and proactively prepare ourselves for the world as we think it's going to be, rather than you know, a headline pops up or it jumps upon us, and then we're reacting to it. So that's that is what we're doing. We're just trying to foresee as much as we can what's coming our way. As I said, it's not just a council project. This is a project with the universities and with business community, voluntary sector, care sector, and police and so forth. That's the best we can do. Using that paper as the basis for, one, looking at our own planning and how it influences the refresh of the Bristol One City plan, but also how it shapes our conversations with other cities across the UK, towns and cities, and with national government. So look, this is what's coming. Work with us on this. Yeah, so we've now appointed a chair, a fantastic chair, Tim Cole. And one is, as a human being, he's a good guy, has that mix of ferocious intelligence and humility and gentleness, I think, which is ideal for the role. But also, as his specialism historically, it was on the Holocaust, the ghettoisation, and memorials, actually. And we have around about seven members. We have historians, but we also have philosophers, a legal expert, someone who's been very involved in community and Colston, in Dr. Sean Sobers, but also has worked a lot on community media as well. So we have a fantastic mix of people. And what they've done is they've started to craft out their work plan and how they're going to approach it. Two things I would say. One is it's really important that they've set out at the beginning. Colston is the departure point, but it's not the destination. You know, the point is not to define Bristol's future simply in terms of this is not Colston or the opposite of Colston, because the perversion of that would be that you are basically defining the city in terms of Colston just by anyway. So Colston is the launch pad for an investigation of who we are. And the way Tim sets it out, I think, is quite beautiful. And the first question is, what have we remembered? And then you engage the whole city. So that's about race, and it's about, and it has to be about black people within there. Colston is the departure point. But actually, it's all about class. It's about women. It's about gay people. It's about disabled people. It's about the working class, trade unions. And when you have a fuller understanding of Bristol's story, then you'll have more material to say, well, actually, this is what we've remembered in our big grand story. But actually, is that an accurate reflection? Does that really portray Bristol as it is? And within that is the other question, what have we chose not to remember, right? So who's been forgotten from this history? So that's where they are, and they're getting work. The other principle is really important to recognise is that they will be reaching out to community groups across the city. So they are not doing new research and doing stuff. What they're doing is they're convening, reinterpreting, representing existing research from dusty old books that are on the shelves, but getting contributions from community groups from across the city as well, like the Brislington History Group, for example. What does that tell us about Brislington? How do we map that into the broader themes and stories that they are reinterpreting to the city? So you know, my hope, and I'm very confident, is that they will give the city a stronger sense of self and more mature material in which to decide who we are and who we want to become.
You've had, you know, a significant events happen like the renaming of the Colston Hall and Bristol. Do you think Bristol is now coming to terms with a lot of these things? I thought certainly the reaction to the renaming of Colston Hall was much better received than it's been, the arguments have been in the past, for example.
Although an image comes into my mind, the difference between, or the public reception of the difference between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was seen as America's most dangerous man until Malcolm X offered them an alternative. So, you know, the renaming of Colston Hall might have been a dramatic moment if the statue hadn't been pulled down. But as it were, I mean, I've been quite taken that the openness of people to actually saying, you know what, we do need to have a think about ourselves. And in my office and with me, I've been at pains to say, we need to lead Bristol in a way and make decisions and campaign, I would say, recognising the fact that we're going to have to live with each other after. No one's going anywhere. So we need to work in a way that means that if you get what you wanted, you feel respected. You feel, you feel that Bristol's your home. If you don't get what you wanted, you still feel Bristol is your home. You feel respected. And even if you get what you didn't want, Bristol's your home and you feel respected. And that's about the process, the integrity of the process, the inclusive nature of the process we will get to. Because the truth is, in any city, Everyone's going to experience those things, so very different. And the art of city making is creating space in which people have contrasting worldviews, very different perceptions, can find a place in which they can live together. Even if they don't like each other, we can live together. I'd say housing has been hard because it took a reorientation of the authority. It took, taking resources away from the arena in many ways, to something that people weren't going to live in, the legal power, the planning power, and saying actually Bristol's priorities are delivering houses for people. And it was a real challenge. Can I say one of the hardest moments as well in my time, actually, my office will laugh because I'm always talking about the arena, was the decision of Temple Island. Look, it came to the point we knew that there was a political decision and there was the right decision. And the discussion was there. Do you make the political decision or do you make the right decision? The political decision is easy. You know, we took 50 million quid off the delivery price. Here you go, Bristol. Here's your arena on Temple Island. But the finances of that were disastrous for the city. And we made the right decision, even though people were saying this is going to lose you the election. But if I can indulge me for a moment, Andrew, if we had borrowed £160 million to build an arena and we were trying to open it right now in the middle of the pandemic, we'd have £160 million empty building, making no revenue against which we'd be making our mortgage repayments. We said there was huge risk involved in the arena, and it was a risk the city could not afford to take on, and the risk of catastrophe was too high. And the current situation shows that we were right. But it was a very, very hard decision at the time.
And the second part of that question was, what's the biggest regret in terms of your 4 years?
I think the biggest regret was watching the usual ping pong of party politics begin to reassert itself. I said, look, there's only so long I can hold a hand out to you while you keep chewing on my fingers. You know, nobody would. And what they say, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And at some point, you just have to say, do you know what? This is something we want to do, but I'm recognising that Bristol is not mature enough, the political system in Bristol is not mature enough to facilitate those kind of relationships. And that was really disappointing. And to accompany that is, in to some degree, and I'm not going to get into it here, but just the poor quality of some of the civic debate. And I said this around Colston coming down. You know, it's not just national, it's local. But, you know, most issues are a lot more complicated and nuanced than they're presented. You can't capture it in a statement or an easy headline or a point of conflict. You know, most things are, you're kind of 80% right. Someone else has got a point of view. Or actually you're saying, do you know what, you're right, but I'm right too. What we do is have these two things that are right at the same time, or we've got two things that are bad at the same time, and what we're trying to do is take the least worst option. COVID is an example. The medical threat and the economic threat, it's an example of that. And the loss of space to have those kind of discussions in the city is, I think, is actually one of the biggest threats to the health of our democracy. That's how Trump got in. He was great media fodder, and he got massive profile because he gave you the conflict, he gave you the sensation. He did not give you the nuance. He didn't give you the, well, that's a good point, but kind of arguments. And I think it's a huge threat to us. And it poisons our stories. Is it the West African author, I quoted, it said, if you want to destroy people, poison the stories they tell about themselves. And there are lots of poison stories floating around the city. That's a real disappointment, and it's a challenge we need to take on.
And that's something which we'll be doing more on next year in terms of issues around the future of democracy, freedom of speech and so on. We are out of time, I'm afraid, and I did promise to Nikki that I would end on time, given the valiant work that she's been doing. But I'm sorry we couldn't get to at least 80 of the now over 100 questions we've been given. But as I said, the Mayor's office will respond to those questions later on, and we'll post them on our blog.